I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University, based here in Frio, the great town, port city of Fremantle. Welcome back, Martin.
It's fabulous to be here, Michael.
We're a lovely sort of microcosm of peace, joy, happiness and camaraderie here in Fremantle. But the more I think about it, Martin, the world is ruled by politics, philosophy and religion. How can you teach politics without philosophy and religion dabbling, I wonder? Take today, we're going to cover topics as wide as the Anti-Corruption Commission in Canberra, The Voice, which bubbles along and people are becoming nasty towards each other. Loot is being returned by imperial nations to their former colonies out of some sort of act of generosity, if not politics. Israel keeps bombarding the Palestinians, this time in the Jenin camp. And even sport has politics in it. We'll get to the wicketkeeper before long, Martin. But let's start with the NAC, the NAAC, the National Anti-Corruption Commission in Canberra. It opened its doors this week. Looks like lots of people have made referrals. The Commissioner, Paul Brereton, did a public viewing of himself and fellow commissioners at the beginning of the week and tried to pour a little bit of common sense out onto the table for people to see and perhaps dampen expectations, mixing all of my metaphors. So what do you think we can expect from the NAC? Are we going to get 50 reports in the first 6 months?
No, I think they'll be selective about what they can investigate. And there have been massive numbers of, I think it was first it was 44, then it was in excess of 100 after a week of operation. What you get is you get all sorts of people who say, this is corrupt activity, investigate. And it's similar to people who go to police with a complaint. The police have to weed through that and work out what they can investigate. And it is difficult, and it is sometimes a subjective judgment, but it will be based predominantly around evidence and whether there's something to actually go on in terms of the allegations which are put to them. So it will be quite tricky for them, and they'll have to focus. There'll be a lot of scrutiny on the things that they choose to take up and the things that they don't. Whenever you are starting a new body like this, the building of trust and faith in the institution during its early days is critical. ICAC in New South Wales, to a lesser extent here, the CCC, because it's not as well known, but that's built up trust over a long period of time. And, you know, therefore it's, you know, it's seen as separate from politics. Now, it does invariably infringe upon politics. And I think there's no way around it. Politicians will continue to refer their opponents to ICAC at times and make noise about that. Of course, a referral itself doesn't mean much because anyone can refer anyone to the NAC. I could refer you, Michael, to NAC. It doesn't actually mean anything. I have to find some misdemeanor of yours, Michael.
Refer Fremantle Shipping Years, be very good publicity.
So that doesn't, it doesn't, so for the listeners, it doesn't actually mean anything, but when the NAC announces an investigation into an issue, that does start meaning more because it means that they've got some evidence they believe to go on. So watch for that. I think that's what will be really, really interesting. There's a high threshold for public hearings. I don't expect we'll see a lot of those. When we do, it will be extremely interesting and they'll make for fascinating viewing. But I certainly hope that we get to the bottom of a whole range of things. And there's plenty of policy decisions in recent years that could and should have been referred to an anti-corruption commission had it existed.
It is really interesting. And the point you make, Martin, with respect to are very good ones. Paul Brereton, the commissioner, emphasised some of those things in various ways at the opening this week. One thing he hinted at, I think, was that the commission perhaps won't have time or won't be interested in pursuing matters that have a real ancient history to them. So you can expect they won't be going backwards in time. He also emphasised that corrupt conduct under the legislation under which the Commission operates is not always criminal conduct. It's conduct which might be a breach of public trust, as in the case of the Berejiklian report that we discussed last week. It's all about making sure there's integrity in the in public sector decision making. And it's not only public officials who can bring that undone. It can be people on the outside who are dealing with public officials who can strive to bring it undone. So it's going to be fascinating to see what happens. We had the Robodebt Royal Commission report announced really as we speak. There have been references made by the Royal Commissioner for civil and criminal action to be taken. We don't know the details yet. The time for reporting was extended until the 7th of July, which means today. It's possible that there could be some references to the NAC. One sort of doubts it, but we'll find out. There's the PwC matter, which has been bubbling along in Canberra for some weeks now. One wonders whether that might get a Guernsey. And there's also the question concerning the former minister, Robert, and whether or not the matter and the allegations there will be taken up. I guess we'll just continue to watch it with great interest. Martin, the next topic really is the Voice. It looks like the gloves are coming off. People have been writing articles around the country for respectful debate, and people have been trying to be polite. But there was a cartoon in the Australian Financial Review yesterday or the day before, which was really quite appalling. It struck for me a Jim Crow southern part of the United States tone, with a parliamentarian Kate Cheney as a little girl sitting on her father Michael's knee, he being presently the chair of the West Farmers Board and offering a huge wad, perhaps $2 million,
Thomas Mayo, I think it was.
Thomas Mayo was the person, and had him dancing around. They've since withdrawn it and apologised. But are we going to see more of this sort of conduct? I mean, how do you control it?
It is that was particularly shocking. We're getting a lot of campaigning around this. It has got increasingly nasty. It is really unfortunate that a proposal that's designed to bring people together, and let's face it, people will have lots of reasonable criticism of any proposal like this, that's fine, but it's really degenerated at times into some really nasty debate, and this was a great example of that, I think. I was surprised it was run. I think, this is not a cartoon that sort of snuck its way into page 75 like we saw in the West a few years ago. This is some major full-page advertisement. How can you miss that? That's, it's astonishing that the AFR ran that as a full-page advertisement. And Channel 9 have apologised this morning for running it. I think that they recognise that there was a serious error made there. But it's probably just the thin end of the wedge when it comes to the sorts of debate that we have seen or we could see in coming months around this.
One of the issues that is close to impossible to control is what people have said or say on social media. Of course, we've now got Threads as a Meta competitor to Twitter, so people can get busy there. There's Instagram, there's Facebook, there's a range of other social media. And I guess this is where a lot of the less than subtle debate is playing out, Martin. I suppose there'll be no end to that.
Oh, look, I think if you want to go into the sewer, you certainly can in social media. There's plenty of trending topics. Now, some of this under the previous sort of Twitter management was eliminated, and there was a large moderation team dedicated to trying to keep that kind of stuff off. A lot of those people were sacked and let go. I think there's a push for free speech on Twitter, which, as a principle, we all appreciate, but It does open the door for this kind of stuff. And there has been more of this kind of content, I think, on social media than there has been previously. And that's really and a really awful and disturbing thing to see, because it's all very well for people like myself and yourself, Michael, but we put ourselves in the shoes of people, the targets of such discussion and, you know, posts and the like. It's really unpleasant.
Well, it's amazing how the No campaign seeks to try and draw a divide between the people it wants to call the elite, who sometimes have a voice, sometimes just want to express it, and some other unknown group of people. Perhaps they're trying to refer to or reference John Howard's battlers out there in the community. It's a very strange tactic, but I suppose not a surprising one. But Linda Burney, in her press club speech this week, tried to narrow the discussion, to get away from will the voice be making submissions about parking tickets and the like, and said, look, we're interested in health, education, housing and employment. We'd love to hear from a voice on those topics. What's the tactic, if you like, or the point she's trying to make?
I thought it was a really clear tactic there, and it was to try and reassure people that the issues the voice would be tackling were really practical issues that all of us should want tackled. Housing, education, employment, jobs, and I think I've missed one. They're things that anyone would want to see resolved with reference to Indigenous people in Australia. So I think that's it's a clear calculation to try to emphasise its broad importance and relevance, rather than the attack by the No campaign that it's going to be bureaucratic and it's going to be about stopping development and this and that and the other. But the irony about this argument about elites is any large scale national campaign is at least part funded by elites. So what do you think is happening in the No campaign as well as the Yes campaign? There's plenty of elites throwing money at both campaigns. And guess what? There's plenty of politicians fronting both campaigns. So it's a very facetious campaign. But look, honestly, I'm not that surprised that they're running the sort of insiders versus outsiders thing.
Martin, everything going on with The Voice reminds us of the colonial experience. So many people, if not just about everybody around the globe, had from about the 1600s on, as the European countries dominated the world and exploited Indigenous peoples everywhere. But for a little while now, we've been seeing discussion and positive actions where those former colonial masters have been returning the loot, so to speak. Latest example being the Netherlands promising to return treasures that they took from Indonesia and Sri Lanka in the colonial era. What do you make of all of this? What is the impetus for it, and will it have beneficial outcomes?
This is not going to go away. It's only going to get more heat as time goes on, because there's that sad reality that many of those great museums around the world are actually repositories for stolen goods. That's the harsh reality. The British Museum, the Vatican Museum, the Louvre, they're fantastic museums. And I've been fortunate to go to them. They're extraordinary to see the exhibits there. But they were almost exclusively taken without payment from subjects. And so I think if you look at that in the cold light of day, they've been stolen. And probably the most high profile example of all time is the Elgin marbles that sit in the British Museum that the Greeks for decades, probably over a century, have been trying to get back, and the Brits have no intention of returning, because they know if they start returning that, they've got to return the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. Now the Rosetta Stone should go back to Egypt, for instance. What would these museums be if they didn't have all of this stuff that they've been taken from other parts of the world? But I think we're starting, the pressure that's on former colonial masters to return these goods is only going to increase, because they're of national significance and particular cultural significance to the areas that they were taken from. So it's not going away. It's only going to get more marketed, I think.
Martin, something else that's not going away, one feels entirely despairing about, is the continuing conflict between Israel and those that are more or less within Israel's borders. Israel is such a tiny little country, Martin. It's about 470 kilometres from the north to the south. It's only about 135 kilometres at its width, at its widest point. It's got some distinct regions within it. There's also the occupied West Bank, which is a rather large area in which the Jenin refugee camp's based. But Israel have gone in big time. They haven't done anything like this in a couple of decades. And there's so many questions that come up, not the least of which is whether Benny is so weak at the moment that he has to fawn to his very right-wing parliamentary colleagues and show how tough he is. What do you make of this latest conflict?
There have been previous raids in Jenin that we are going back a while since they've happened. And if you want to understand the intersection between sort of militancy and civilians and how civilians, particularly women and children, are impacted by conflict, Jenin's an interesting case study because Jenin is a refugee camp. It's a refugee camp which has also been at times a base for certain militants. So it's got both elements in it, but a raid like this obviously bundles up a whole range of completely innocent people amongst that. So it's another example of this flashpoint where there are plenty of militant people on both sides who are using violence, and there are plenty of innocent victims in the middle. And there's already a lack of resources, there's already a lack of an isolation with the outside world that has taken place in the Jenin refugee camp and has for a long time, as well as in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And these things only increase and consolidate that isolation.
It's amazing, isn't it, how war goes on. I mentioned at the beginning politics, philosophy and religion. When you start teaching students, whether undergraduates or graduates, about political science and international relations, do you spend some time on the topics of philosophy and religion? It seems that they are two topics where we try to ameliorate the worst instincts of humans. At the same time, they seem to be two of the greatest causes of conflict.
Oh, and certainly, I think you cannot look at politics without considering ideology, which is derived from ideas, and religion. They're all interbound, and both philosophy and religion contributed extraordinarily to the suite of human ideas, and they've also been tools for extremists and weapons for people to commit atrocities. So it is a fascinating melting point. I think Israel-Palestine is one such example, but it's by no means alone. In fact, you'll find these factors in many areas of conflict, bound up in lots of other hotspots around the world, sadly. And you need to understand the full suite of those forces when it comes to violence and generally conflict around the globe. So we've sometimes put these things in the past and pretend that everything's all good now, but I think we're a long way from that.
Well, there's one important philosophical text that gets referred to from time to time, and that's Wisden on cricket, Martin. And in it, you'll see a chapter on the spirit of cricket. Another one of these ideas, perhaps more honoured in the breach. And in the second test at Lord's between Australia and England, the Australian wicketkeeper, Alex Carey, brilliant piece of wicketkeeping in the sense that he actually hit the stumps from where he was standing way back to run out the opposing batsman wicketkeeper, Johnny Bairstow. Caused an enormous rift between the teams, which is, in a sense, being physically played out in the third test at this very moment. But the prime ministers of England and Australia got caught up in it all. Sport and politics, they plainly, they're good for politics, these contests in sports, or are they not?
Oh, I think that they add life, energy, vitality. I'm an unashamed cricket fan, Michael, and I love all of its vicissitudes. And I think the controversies help, you know, enliven sport and add to the, you know, intensity. Sport is incredibly emotive and passionate pastime, isn't it? And no less than Anthony Albanese and Swinny Rishak, the two prime ministers, got involved. It's also incredibly tribal, and that's another mirror for politics, isn't it? You look at those events through the lens that you come from. And so I think it's sometimes, as Australians, we look at these things and say, this is the colonial masters setting the rules for us. And then when we play by those rules, they still don't like it if they're disadvantaged. But look, it's been fascinating to watch. I think if ever Australia was going to become a republic, it's probably because of another bodyline incident more than anything else. So the passions has just been fascinating to watch.
Rishi Sunak came out agreeing with the English captain, Ben Stokes, that he wouldn't have done what Alex Carey did, or if it happened, he would have told the umpires to cancel the out decision. And then, of course, as you say, Anthony Albanese chimed in with a little bit of humour. Are they playing, though, in a serious political game, do you think? Sunak has an election coming up before too many months pass.
I think, you've got to remember our prime ministers are, to some extent, cheerleaders for their country on the national stage, international stage. So it's a no-brainer in my view that you would have both those prime ministers weighing in carefully with their political advisors in their ear to ensure that they fly the flag for their relative teams. So I don't think that's that much of a surprise. Of course, it helps the British PM, but it also helps our PM as well to be seen to go into bat, pun intended, for Australia.
Well, you're right. It might well be cricket that brings about the Republic of Australia in the end. Martin, I won't ask you to predict what's going to happen this week in Geneva, New York, Tel Aviv, even Fremantle. It's going to be another amazing week ahead of us, I imagine.
I think so. It's never a dull week.
Never a dull week. Thanks for joining me this morning. It's been great talking with you as always.
My pleasure.